I'd like to spend some time together talking about recycling in the church today. And I think it might be kind of fun to give a little bit of background first. It would be helpful, I hope, to you. And I hope as you're discussing, because I hope there is time to discuss, and would encourage you is to just jump in and participate in the discussion as we go, rather than waiting until the end. I'd like to sort of tell you about where some things have come from. Study of care for the earth has really been a sort of something that's been part of my ministry for quite a while. And when the new church was formed, our synod gathered to set up new committees, and I volunteered to be on the committee that we call Church in the World. We don't call it Church in Society because we really feel that that really doesn't speak to all the issues today. When that group first met, we went around and shared our agendas, and I said, well, my major agenda is that we start a task force in our synod on care for the earth. And went through official channels, and a year later we started. And then I had the opportunity of looking around and asking a number of people from various congregations, from people in the sciences and various vocations, if they would like to be on the task force. And our task force has now been meeting for about a year and a half. The first year, in our meetings, we spent a couple of months asking ourselves, what do we want to be about and what do we want to do? And we said right away that we wanted to serve the congregations of our synod. And what we did or what we produced, we wanted it to be helpful for every congregation. And then we asked ourselves, what can we do right away that's practical, that's hands-on, and can really help congregations get involved with caring for the earth? And so we started with something very practical. And what we did was to write a committee paper on recycling that I'll share with you, and we'll spend almost all of our time with today. But it was done to help congregations and also put together in such a way that we hoped that it would help congregations set up their own task forces in caring for the earth. Our next project, by the way, is to have a training event this next April for congregations to become what we call Creation Awareness Centers. And that will, that's being planned right now, along with hopefully, we were looking for funding when I left the 1st of July to put together a series of three videos done by Dr. Cal DeWitt from the University of Wisconsin, who is a really very devout Christian, wonderful scientist, and has been recognized by the United Nations, and can speak very plainly so that everyone can understand. He just has some wonderful gifts. The first one of those is on why should Christians care about creation. Secondly, a tape on what he calls the seven degradations of the earth, in other words, the ways that we are participating in the ruination of the planet. And then the third one of those is the church as a creation awareness center. We're hoping to have those videos available sometime in the near future, and we're going to produce them so that congregations and synods can get a hold of them. I'd like to read a quote from the paper, and then I'd like to give one to each of you. We tried to put a few quotes in the paper, and one of those in the front page, along with a quote from Genesis and Psalms and Colossians and the Luther Book of Worship, is from E.F. Schumacher. And I think it sort of helps to understand some things in perhaps a little deeper level. The smallest mosquito is more wonderful than anything man will ever produce. So man must never lose his sense of the marvelousness of the world around and inside him, a world which he has not made and which, assuredly, has not made itself. Such an attitude engenders a spirit of nonviolence. I think as human beings, we've gotten into a sense of in which we somehow feel that everything must relate its importance to us as human beings. And for me, the mosquito helps me understand some things. I ask the question, especially when I'm out trout fishing, and there are too many of them around, why on earth, God, did you create mosquitoes? And after thinking about that for quite a while, I've come to the conclusion that God did not create everything for me. And everything has its own sense of self-worth and its own sense of belonging to the creation. And the mosquito and the creatures like it helped me understand that. And I think if you begin to think about that, especially in how we deal with things that we are now wondering if they're dealing with in terms of recycling, it helps to put that into a little broader frame. I have with me about 20-some of these that I would like you to at least look at. You can, if you want, have this. We're running out back at a Synod level, and so we were charging, I forget, yeah, $2 or $3 for these at the end, so we could reprint some more. But if you don't have $2 or $3 and you want one, I want you to keep it, all right? That's more important. We'll just find church money for it.
Something free for you.
There's no free lunch.
But I'm hoping that, you know, this might help you. We, when we wrote this, decided, first of all, that we would send one to each of the 153 congregations in our synod. And we sent one to each of the synod offices around the country, and then to a few other places, seminaries and so forth, that we thought might want these. Certainly one to Holder Village right away, and Resource Center here. And then it was really wonderful, and I know that others have done this. The Presbyterian Church has done this as well, and done a very fine job with that. We didn't know about that when we did ours. But we received a number of other requests for it, and we've run out of about 400 of them right now. So it's really been fun. First of all, I'd like you to know that we tried very hard to be responsible with this. We really felt that the paper, along with dealing with just the practicalities of recycling, we really felt that we needed to deal statistically with the causes of some problems today. We really felt that we needed a biblical, ethical, theological section in the paper. And we also needed some, besides some practical hints, we needed some good solid science in the paper as well, so that it had some sense of responsibility. And so we tried to integrate all of these things with the committee. And the wonderful thing is that we had a person who edited for the Department of Natural Resources for the state of Wisconsin for 34 years and is retired. And we gave her all of our stuff and she edited this for us. Peter and I, who wrote the biblical theological section, had 18 pages and didn't think we could do without a single paragraph. And she reduced it to 5 pages and we tried to figure out what she'd left out. she's a very fine person. And we appreciate Ruth Hine very much. If I were to give credit for this paper to anyone, it would be to Ruth, who does some wonderful things. First of all, you'll notice that we deal with the problem of recycling, or the need for it, and we call that section throwaway. And I'd like to read some sections of this, certainly not the whole thing, and would encourage you again to jump in and make some comments as we go. And those comments need not be positive. Feel free to be critical as well. I want this to be a real give and take session. Everything is used and reused in God's created order. Nothing goes to waste. The fox that dies in the woods, the acorn that escapes the squirrel's watchful eye, are gradually turned into soil by myriads of unseen plants and animals, to later nourish the violet and the maple seedling and the next generation of foxes. But humankind does not follow nature's example. We have become a throwaway society. Every day we throw out everything from toothpaste tubes to our old TV sets, grass clippings to plastic milk jugs, jelly jars to paper. If you add all the waste from homes, schools, churches, from factories, utilities, stores, it amounts to about 7.5 pounds a day for each person. This means that in a year, Wisconsin citizens throw away more than 6.5 million tons of stuff, enough to pile a typical city street 6 feet deep, curb to curb, for 500 miles, more than the distance from Superior to Chicago. We've had some folks who've taken the paper and they've made this a little more regionally specific, and we've encouraged them to do that. So, but you can begin to see then from the chart where the wastes come from.
Is that a national average 7.5, or is that just Wisconsin?
I don't know. I think it's a national
figure.
I think it's a national average. I really do.
I wonder how many other communities do, like we live in Seattle, and in our whole area, we recycle, like we have one day a week, we have all of our yard waste is picked up and garbage, and then once a month we have all of our paper picked up and all the metal, and you take the paper off the cans and you clean them and you smash them, and all of the glass and you clean them and you take the paper off, and these are all picked up then once a month. Everything is separated, and in our area the whole thing is
through the city.
Yes, it's all done through the city, but it's in our whole area, not just the city. It's county, and I don't know how many counties do
that. Washington recycles more than any other state. We have the highest recycling rate in Washington.
Is that right? That's wonderful.
But it's only about 21%.
But we don't even have a bottle bill. Think what we could do with that.
So you don't have a bottle bill either?
No bottle bill. They won't vote for it.
We lost that in Wisconsin too, our last recycling bill, yeah.
Yeah, and ours has been up 3 times. Yeah.
And I don't understand that.
The bottle companies fought us. I mean, they came up from San Francisco and fought us one-on-one all over the state. Mm-hmm.
They did that in Wisconsin too. A very strong lobby. Remember, and,
they spent $1 million.
The place you see it really functioning is go to Michigan.
It's working, huh?
You get in the big cities and get in the back road. And as much as they've been hollering, what they didn't tell you is they get a penny a bottle, a penny a can for just taking care
just
of it.
Just for hauling, yeah.
So they're making, they can employ one person just to take the bottles and smash the cans and sort the cans and take the plastic bottle and throw them somewhere else. Because when the man hauls them away, he has to pay him a penny a can. Mm-hmm. And when you got a big store going and you get into those metropolitan areas in Michigan, there are lots of bottles, and there's no bottles laying around. My son went to college up there. He said, you'd be surprised how the college gets scrounged for those cans.
Mm-hmm. I know that state of Iowa, where I grew up, has the bottling cans, and you just don't see them along the roads. And people go out and pick them up.
Well, in Ohio, where I live, you can make yourself a pretty penny. All you got to do is get yourself a three-wheel bike and drive slowly and get a stick with the nail on it and jab those cans.
One of the arguments against it was Michigan was trying to get at the bottle bill the same time we were, and they said that, what would the scout troops do if they couldn't have those cans to return? They get, a great one.
Well, they fight it real dirty. They, when they brought it up in Illinois, I read it was something from the industry, and the journalist just inserted it in the article, and it was he was saying that it's going to cause levels of disease are going to raise because we're going to have all this stuff is going to be sitting around in the back room of grocery stores. It's really unsanitary.
Yeah, they told us they had. I kid the guy, asked him if they had plagues in the grocery stores in Oregon, and he shut his mouth because they don't have any trouble down there.
Well, if you go all the way to the East Coast, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, four of them I think have it.
Probably.
And when you get the can, they're all stamped on there, so if you buy a can in New Hampshire, take it to Maine, you get your knife. Mm-hmm. But you don't see any cans, you don't see any bottles, and there's very little plastic.
And it's interesting how the companies can specify which state, even by putting it on your return for 5 cents, Oregon.
Or 10 cents. Yeah. Some of them say, some of them are dimes. Save them. When you get to a dime state, give them all away or take it.
One of the things I'd like to have us sort of do today is and we're going to come from places where this is happening to different degrees, okay? And as wonderful as it is with Washington and Oregon does fairly well, and Wisconsin is starting and so forth, that's still 21%. And I'm a person who believes that you don't tackle these things by having to do everything yesterday. We're going to have to start with some sense of moderation so we can grow into some of this again. This has taken some time to evolve, and if we try that, it's going to become so overwhelming and so depressing for people that it just isn't going to work. But my hope is that the stages can, we can move rapidly through some stages. And the ideal, I think, is that we move very quickly from 40% to certainly well over 50 and beyond. And the other question that I think, though, in regard to this is that we always have to ask is that while our municipalities are picking up all of these things, you still have to ask the question, what are they doing with them? Are there sources that are really recycling these things at the other end so that there is reuse, or are they simply collecting them and putting them in landfills for us? Because in some instances, that's exactly what happens, because there is no one at the other end who is tooled and ready to go and recycling paper and so forth. I want to move through the paper a little bit more. The question that we raise then is, after you look at some more statistics there for Wisconsin, where is away if you throw something away? What does it mean to throw something away? I mean, there's some sort of basic questions that we want to raise. Most solid waste ends up in landfills, a place where waste is dumped, compacted and covered with dirt to control blowing paper, odors, insects, and rodents. Wisconsin has 3,800 landfill sites. 2,700 are already closed, leaving 1,100 licensed landfills occupying some 14,000 acres of land, the equivalent of 70 typical Wisconsin farms. So what's the problem? And then we go through and try and lay that out. Water becomes polluted, air becomes polluted, wildlife and habitat is destroyed, valuable land is lost, NIMBY, nobody wants it in their backyard. Some wastes may never decay, you know, and so forth. And then we have a section, and I, unless you want to talk about this more, we felt that the styrofoam question in churches needed to be addressed, because as Lutherans, we drink a lot of coffee out of styrofoam cups. It's a hands-on kind of thing that you can deal with that. And we realized that styrofoam is not just a simple black and white issue. First of all, there are different kinds of styrofoam. Some use CFCs and some don't. It's important to know the difference. It's also important to know that some of the substitutes that we choose, paper that's covered with some sort of plastic material, isn't necessarily that much better. And that also goes to filling landfills. You know, what are the substitutes that we're choosing? And even if we go to what our church, where I come from now, feels is the best substitute, that is to wash those cups, we're still using detergents and water. I mean, there's no, you know, we don't come 100% clean on any of these issues, and it helps to maintain that sense of reality, I think, so that we don't become so pristine and so self-righteous about what we're doing. And I think that's extremely important. I am going to spend a little time on the theological basis for recycling, because quite frankly, I believe that the reason the church brings an issue like this up is because of who we are as sinners people. We should be in this sort of a thing. We should have been in it from the beginning, and we should be in all of these issues for the long run. We should never get out of them. It should be inherently part of who we are as God's people. And there are reasons for that, but quite frankly, I think we've lost sight of some of those reasons. First of all, we talk about creation as being good. Good. Now let me illustrate that. Give me some words that we use to describe the things we throw away.
Junk.
Just keep firing away.
Garbage. Rubbish.
Waste.
rubbish, waste.
Trash.
Trash. What about disposable?
That's a wonderful one.
Well, what is it? What is a sanitary landfill?
An oxymoron.
That's right. I mean, what's sanitary about a landfill? It's not a sanitary place. Why should we call it that?
And how can something be a landfill anyway? It's just covered with land. It doesn't fill anything but space.
I come out of Chicago, and landfills in Chicago have really been a godsend. And, you know, I know now they may not be doing it, they may not then, but I do know that all of Grant Park and most of the south side along the lake, all the way out about to about 215th Street, is all on garbage. And some of that property today is some of the most expensive property in the city of Chicago. And the way they handle, they put it on trains on the north side and haul it to the south side, dumped her in there. So there have been places where landfills, I think, have served their purpose.
But what do we know about what's leaching out of those
landfills? Well, the darn things were done 50 years ago. I don't know what's leaking out of it. The grass looks green all the time.
Well, but how's the groundwater? You know, I guess...
Around Chicago, that's one big swamp. The whole bottom south end of the lake is all swamp for about 20 miles in.
O'Hare
was wetlands.
Well, and that's a problem because wetland drainage is a
severe problem. The whole city is built on this.
Right. Well, I know it. So
lots
is Madison.
Of cities.
So is
We lived there for a while, and every time it rained, our basement filled with water because all the wetlands were filled, and there was no place for it to go.
Right.
See, ours was, our basement used to fill to the city of Chicago, put in an 8-foot water drain.
To make up for the wetland they already drained. I guess my only point is that yes, it's some of the most economically valuable land now, but at what cost? At what cost in the ecostructure? For people, it's nice to have a place
as
to live on the lake.
As of yet, I have yet to see something come out in any kind of a paper, any kind of newspaper, or any kind of notice somebody's going to talk about it, that there's been inherent damage done. I'm not saying that it isn't, but I'm saying that up till now, none of the scientific field have opened up their mouth. I know in Cincinnati, for instance, they heat 15,000 homes off the methane gas that comes out of the winter landfills. And they expect that to go on for years.
Yeah. Maybe the effect of a 1,500-year or whatever-year-old landfill in Chicago is what enables the dead to rise in Chicago, at least on every election day.
You also, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I don't know. I don't want to say anything. But the simple point I want to make here is, what does it say about our understanding of the creation when we as human beings take part of it for our own use and say, well, yes, everything that God creates is good, but then we reduce it to junk, garbage, rubbish, waste, trash, disposable, and put it in sanitary landfills? What does that say about our whole understanding of life and our faith statement on Sunday morning when we say, I believe in God, Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth? What does that say about our understanding or our faithfulness as God's people in dealing with the creation? And I think it raises some major questions about us. And it becomes a faith issue right away when we treat God's creation as junk rather than something good. We also say in the paper that all of life is interrelated, that no species or individual is self-sufficient. And so we need to ask ourselves about how our behavior affects other species, certainly other human beings, but other species as well. What we produce, what we consume, what are the long-term effects, not just the short-term effects? Do we really deal with those issues before we produce things? And I think the answer is sort of a yes and no with that. Sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't. The other statement we make, next one, is that creation is finite. We have a sense that we can continue to use and consume things in huge volumes without really dealing with the fact that things are finite. And we realize that now. We realize that the oil in the earth, unless we discover mass quantities somewhere else, are going to run out. Some say in about the year 2030 or so, if we continue to use oil at the rate that we are. Now, I realize some of this is debatable, but even the argument itself points out the fact that the creation is finite and that it can be used up. And the next section we entitle Our Failure to Respect Creation. The fundamental causes of the environmental crisis are human. They really are. And that's not to say that the rest of creation doesn't. There aren't some wastes and so forth. But I talked about this last night a little bit. I just briefly mentioned this. But I'd like to raise a question to you and ask you to help me with it. If we were to deal with our humanness and our fallenness in handling the creation, and if we were to call our misuse of the creation sinfulness, what are some of the root causes of that within the human community? I mentioned three last night, and I don't want to just throw them up on the board right away. But what are some of the root negative causes that come from the human community that cause us to use the creation in an improper way?
We want more than we need.
So greed.
Greed.
It's greed, but it's also a lack of seeing the whole picture. We don't know that what our greed is doing.
And we don't stop to ask about the consequences, do we?
No, like big throwaway lighters. Every time I see those, I see them in bins right next to the checkout stand, and I think it creeps.
Maybe you could add to that, more than we need, more than our share.
We do need some, though. We need a sufficient amount.
Yeah. The word need there is really crucial, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I find it really interesting that when I listen to advertising or read advertising, that it really appeals to almost a pre-adolescent level in life, where they tell us we need something, but really what they're trying to do is make us want something. And there are the difference between, and it's in one of the little textbooks that we used to teach high school kids in the church years ago, is to teach them the difference between wanting something and really needing something. We seem to have lost that sense, and we're being bombarded with that all of the time, and there's a huge difference. There are a lot of things out of my greed that I want that I really don't need. You know.
The basic thing in advertising, I graduated in advertising from the School of Journalism. And the very basic thing is turning wants into need.
Is that right?
You learn that on the first day. Right. You turn wants into need.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
I had a funny little thing happen. I was at home sometime, I don't know, last winter or something, and I was at the table and or sitting around in the family, and I said, "Oh, gee, look at that. I think I need one of those." I don't know what it was. Willie, my 11-year-old, said, "You need it?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Will you die without it?" And I said, "Well, no."
Where can you prove that frame?
Well, the thing is that, and I said, "Where is this coming from?"
Yeah, where did you go?
He says, "From you." Was, no, in school.
Oh.
In school. We have, well, she's a guidance counselor, but she does other things. And she was coming and telling all the children in the school about needs and wants. And you don't need it unless you will die without it.
Other words.
We also
name things, I don't know what the words would be, but we put labels on things that have, that we put less value to, like stomping on carpenter ants or something like that. They have less value, and we name them or treat them as if they were of no value.
Well, we're afraid they're going to come up and bite us. Well, they're going to come up and ruin our food.
Or ruin our house. Yeah. And we do destroy them for those reasons.
You know, what really comes to my mind and flashes on the human level is this the series of Holocaust on TV. This one character, his main job was to dignify everything that they were doing by creating a language for it. And it just jumps back.
More than our share in greed is self-centeredness. And a definition of that that I got from a psychology book is it's not just being selfish, it's not being able to see things from any other viewpoint but your own. It's like, as a nation, we are self-centered. If we use up 40% of the world's resources, what kind of insanity is that? I mean, we are bluntly, by our lifestyle, saying that other people are going to starve. And, you know, I mean, it's that kind of arrogance is just insane.
Also, get back to some really old-fashioned words. Three come to my mind quickly, and greed, of course, is one of them. The self-centeredness you might also term as pride, very inappropriate pride. And then the next one that pops into my head is sloth. Remember the old seven deadly sins?
Yes.
And sloth, let's put that broadly as comfort, because I think we are just enslaved to comfort.
And lazy.
And convenience. Comfort and convenience. Yes, make convenience.
Boy, if you haven't done garbology, you find out that when you do garbology,
comfort,
slothful, we are too lazy carry our stuff to the proper receptacle. Mm-hmm. Just amazing.
I would like to put in with sloth the word ignorance.
That's true.
I mean, it takes work to really find out the facts and to understand what we're doing and what we should be doing or not doing.
Weren't they here? Free, greed, ignorance, and apathy?
Yeah.
No, arrogance.
Arrogance, ignorance,
with,
and greed.
I would put arrogance with pride. Yeah. Arrogance. Yes. Arrogance. Arrogance is false pride.
I meant these to be together.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there is apathy, too, and it's different from ignorance.
Comparable to sloth, though.
Yeah, I guess it's sloth.
Well, these words carry different meanings, though, and it's helpful to put more up. But I guess my point now is with this is that unless we understand some of the root causes, and quite frankly, unless we in the church can really call them and name them what they are, and that is sin, they are, then I'm not sure we're going to really participate in this fully and really begin to deal with this, and also deal with the Christ who came to reconcile us with all creation.
Well, then, that's what I've been sitting here thinking. I thought that last night, and I was getting very frustrated. I didn't say anything. But this gets me frustrated because I'm thinking of when God created man and put him in the Garden of Eden. And he sinned and God threw him out. And I'm sitting here thinking, hey, we can go on like we are, throwing our tin cans, our garbage, our junk, whatever, away. We're killing ourselves and God is going to say, okay, I've had it. That's it. And it's goodbye, cruel world. And I figured, why bother with all this stuff? If we don't do it, God gave me a mind. And if I don't do it, that's my problem. And he's gonna get me.
what we're hoping in the church and our task force and so forth is to empower people to do that, to become part of it.
Maybe one of your words is responsibility there, too.
Yeah. Warm up the problem, something that I've not heard mentioned in a couple of days we've been here. Overpopulation. You read from Schumacher, Tim Bucky Fuller really talked about the concept, along with Schumacher, of planet Earth, that we're in this spaceship and it has a finite amount of resources. how many people can exist on planet Earth, on spaceship Earth? And now you're getting into some real theological, should they have five children in that family? Should you draw the line at 1.5 or not?
When we were here, I was here in December, Dr. Jerry Barney was here. He's headed up Jimmy Carter's Global 2000 report and is still working in that area with other countries. He's a physicist by training, very bright person in dealing with all these issues. And we discussed this for 2 weeks, and we came to the conclusion that that overpopulation perhaps may be at the root cause. But it's really tricky because we had to also talk about population in third world countries, for example, where it also becomes an economic issue, because there you need to have children to guarantee some help in your later years in life. There's no social security system, and with infant mortality being what it is, you have to have more children to make sure that that happens. And so there are all kinds of other issues that are interwoven here, that are interconnected.
And Schumacher talked about Small is Beautiful, appropriate technology.
Yeah.
Rather than coming to that third world country that needs to have a large family to do all the work, rather than coming to them with a $500,000 bulldozer, just come with appropriate technology that they can use to eventually work out of the pattern that they have to have additional long bodies in order to sustain life.
And part of that would be, were you the one who brought up health care last night?
Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to bring up health care. I only meant to bring up that there are other issues facing the church.
And you're absolutely
an example.
Well, you're absolutely right, and health care could be part of that. Because if we guaranteed health care to those people, then they could think differently about the number of children that mm-hmm. they were having. I mean, all of these things are interrelated, which is one of the points we really wanted to make last night. And here again, I think we can begin to see that really interconnectedness of all of these issues. And Larry Rasmussen really made that point when he spoke to us in September. He said one of the things we dare not do now that the two major issues in the world he feels are going to be A, the environmental crisis, and B, the poor versus the rich, power versus the weak, north-south issue in the world that's really surfacing now. We dare not separate those two and make those, issues that are combated within the church, but we need to see that they're complementary issues and work those two together.
Well, not health care as such, but many related issues related to health, I think, are much more important than even the two that you shared. What are we doing with genetic engineering? How does the church deal with, can I pick? Now I think for my next child I would like to have, and write out the menu in your computer of what you would like to have, and you can engineer. We're close to being able to engineer. How does the church deal with that? We are now our own gods.
Major ethical issues.
Yeah. And the church is ignoring them for the moment.
Because it's too hot to handle, that's why.
Yeah.
Actually not. I know my uncle is in biomedical ethics, he's a seminary professor, and he's been working in this field for 15 years, probably. I mean, work is being done, it's just being outspoken.
But it isn't the issue that it doesn't get the publicity that the ecology does, for example.
Perhaps, because this is so immediate. I mean, we're talking about years. The people who are doing genetic, I personally think that genetic engineering also comes under this realm, because we can create things that and let them go, or that we don't know what they're going to do to us, or the waters, or the lands, or so. I think that's intimately connected anyway.
And I would like to put in a plug for birth control information and birth control methods, sharing that sort of appropriate technology with the women who don't want to have kids left and right.
Well, we're seeing, the interconnectedness with this in terms of garbology here. I mean, there's a definite connectedness. The thing that, if you read the section on the biblical theological ethics, we really want very much in our paper to end this on a very positive note, saying We are empowered by, as God's people, to deal with this as Christians. It's Jesus Christ who empowers us to be a new creation. And it isn't, and quite frankly, it doesn't just all fall on our shoulders. We are participating in what God is about. When Paul makes the statement in Colossians, in Jesus all things were created, and in him all things hold together, and in him all things are being reconciled. Okay, the point is, let's get with it, and let's join him in that. And that's part of who we are as God's baptized people. And the question is, can we have faith to believe that, especially in the darkness of some periods where it almost looks hopeless, as though it's impossible, so we want to throw up our hands. It's a faith issue. And all of these issues, as Christians, that ought to be good news. Because isn't that really where we come from as God's people? These are faith issues. And when we get to that point, we ought to celebrate and say, wow, now I've got it. Now I can get on with something. Okay. The next section will get a little bit more practical in the paper. Again, feel free to interrupt. If you have some major thing you want to say.
I want to defend that beast on Higgins Road in Chicago.
The beast on Higgins Road.
Yeah, 8600, ELC headquarters. The reason they're not having all this stuff that everybody wants is we're not supporting them so they can do it. The young lady that's coming to work here for 2 years is leaving a prominent position because they're going to cut again. Now, this is an organization, my God, even RCA doesn't treat their employees this way. Sell your house, move 2,000 miles away, and then in 2 months or 6 months or 2 years, we're going to say we don't need you anymore. And we don't give them anything at all. We just say go back and hope if you're a pastor, maybe they can find your call back there. That's where right. You came from.
Yeah.
But it's strictly financial. I mean, the first time in my ministry, I'm in a Senate that canceled a meeting because they couldn't afford to put us up overnight. Uh-huh. The first time in 35 years that I've heard that story come out. And if it's true, and we're only coming 100 miles, can you imagine what it is if they get an ethical committee going? And they got a guy coming from Berkeley and from Andover, Massachusetts, and from Tampa, Florida, or wherever, that what it costs to bring in 16 of these people who you want on the committee. I don't think the church doesn't want to do it. The church can't afford it. And that's where the buck is.
Yeah, we can never afford to do it. It's environmentally right.
Well, it isn't just the environmental, it's everything. I mean, this gal was into scholarships for foreign students. Zilch, somebody else is going to try to do it. She says, I've got to be doing four jobs now.
What I'm trying to demonstrate today and tomorrow, and I'll put in a direct plug, I think I need to say that, I guess, is that quite frankly, I don't want to put it all on the National Church or the National Committee. I expect in a few years some really good things from that committee because I know some of the people on it. Peter Bakken, who's one of the people who wrote this paper, is on that National Committee, and he's will soon have a PhD in ethics from Chicago. He's just a brilliant guy, young guy. I expect some things, but I don't see, I mean, I think that's really topping out, expecting Higgins Road to do this for us. We are the church. Your congregation is the church. Our task force is the church. We have wonderful resources in Madison. All we need is to call those people forward and put them in a committee, and we did this paper. You know, we were a brand new committee. We started it in March, and we had this ready to go out to congregations in November. We went monthly, it's all. Yeah. I mean, you can do it. You can do it. And there are tons of people in the communities and the church around that need to be affirmed and asked to participate in something like this. I'm convinced of that. And so I really want to lift that up too. And tomorrow we're going to talk about how can we see the church in a new way as a creation awareness center.
And that means the congregation too, the congregation. Not just the large church.
No, not the large church, the congregation. We probably should say the congregation. Cutting down on trash. Recycling is part of the issue. But there are other ways of dealing with trash. And I think we all know that. The second point, besides recycling, what we're already, you know, or just going through our hands, is simply to reduce the quantity of waste that's produced. And then we list a section here of purchasing and how we purchase and so forth, how we can consume less and deal with need and wants more specifically. And also participate in what's being produced. I mean, there's some major questions about what is being produced. I quite frankly am a little radical in this, but I don't think anything should be produced unless within the statements of the government, those people can tell how that particular product can be recycled or reused. It shouldn't be produced, they should not be given permission to create anything like that. I think that's very basic. But I feel very strongly about that, and I don't think that would be, I realize I'm talking about the impossible, I'm waving at windmills, but I think it's also very basic to this. Reuse items. Go to garage sales. We have a church garage sale every year. A couple of my nicest shirts, my white shirt I've been wearing here, cost me 75 cents at the church garage sale. It was a $45 shirt, by the way, at one time. But there, you can, you know, reuse things. Maybe we should recapture what some other generations, especially generations that have gone through the Great Depression, and understand these things firsthand. Listen to these people. And who know? You know, firsthand, the values of reusing things, instead of throwing them away. Repair, compost. We don't have a compost bin at home, but we're going to build one in September when we go back. Since we have been recycling it in our own home with what we can recycle and composting a little bit, I've used a real crude way of composting because we live out in the country and I can throw it out in the garden. And it just disappears.
It's a good way.
We've reduced what we take to the dump because we have to haul it there by, I don't know what degree, but we take a tenth of what we took before. And now I'm starting to look at what are we really taking? And some of those are things that we've had before when we moved into our house. You know, and we just can't find anything else to do with it. But then I think when you start looking at what's left, then we become, I think, creative about what are the needs. Now that we've gone this far, now that we've gotten to this 21%, and I still have this pile of trash that needs to go out, now what do I need to do? What does this stuff that I'm calling trash speak to me about and tell me? And where are the issues with that?
Can you tell us how to do a compost heap in a small neighborhood without being offensive to the neighbors?
There's a wonderful little 45-cent book in the bookstore, a little brochure, and it's called Home Composting or something like that. And it describes a very good way, not only keep it inoffensive, but you never have to turn it. Oh. It's got air columns built.
Is that the one where you sink a big plastic garbage can into the ground?
No.
Well, there's one like that, too, that sounds really sensible.
But then you got to haul it up out of the bottom.
No, this was, I don't know. I wondered.
But there you go, you're burying plastic, and that's...
Oh, no, well, y'all, but this is a permanent thing. You're not burying plastic. This is something that...
Okay.
It's just an inoffensive way in a small space to compost, but I'll have to try to find that one.
I think it's called some composting or something like that, and... It's in the little section of Holden Productions, the sauna and the mine and so forth. Yeah.
It's called
the
Resource Center.
Right, no, it's not by the front door. As you walk into the books, it's at the far right corner.
I've got one of the Resource
Center. Near the children's books.
Yeah. Yes, near the children's books. Yeah.
They can point that out to you in the bookstore.
We bought one, and I recommend buy it. It's a good, easy way to do good compost.
I think just people not knowing how keeps them from doing it.
I agree. If they think that the stuff they're going to throw out is going to be carried off by animals and stink up the neighborhood, then why do it?
You can hear people say it's going to attract rodents. And right there, that's not just right there. Mm-hmm. It's not going to attract rodents any more than garbage cans, the way they are, being knocked over. I mean, I don't know what kind of neighborhood you live in, but
that's
the way we handle our trash does attract rodents.
getting back to one of our spiritual issues, number two up here, about naming things that we're frightened of. For rodent, read rat. Mm-hmm. Read basic human prejudice. Mm-hmm.
Dan.
Honestly, that's been one of my dilemmas of moving from a single-family dwelling in Minnesota to New York City, has been composting, because I now live in a 15-story apartment building in a very urban area, and I have not figured out a way to compost that I can make use of it. Well, we've got recycling, so we can recycle rich everything else, but I've got to look further into composting and maybe make it available to a neighborhood garden or something like that, but it's been that hasn't been an easy one.
Mm-hmm. Picture Central Park with a line of 100 compost.
Al's got this new brochure from this group called Green Spaces, and it's different urban programs. And one of the programs is to have neighborhood gardens. Mm-hmm. But it's called something like Green Spaces, but Committees of Correspondence. And so it's a program that you set up. I mean, that you can become a member of and immediately, you know, get in on, and I see this being a very ground level thing. It'd be real exciting to be part of.
For those of you who live in communities where you cannot put your grass clippings out anymore, put them between your vegetable garden. My gracious, that's the end of your weeds, and beside that, when you grind it up, it really helps the ground when it goes in.
Yeah.
And you may have piles. I mean, it may go up, but it's going to go down. Just relax.
And then leave some of it on your grass, too.
Sure.
Well, that's what they're saying. They're saying all these bag attachments you don't need.
And if you cut it often enough, which we only cut it when it gets really gross, in other people's eyes, it looks nice to us. If you cut it often enough, then the clippings aren't so long that they harm, but instead they mulch and are beneficial to the lawn.
And when you leave your grass longer, it uses less water. Mm-hmm. It drinks up less water.
That's right.
Try having less grass.
Mm-hmm. We have the next section in the paper is called Benefits of Recycling. I think be sure and look in the dining hall at the East End. The group here at Holden has written a long list of benefits for recycling that is, I think, more complete than this. And so if you keep one of these books, why get one of those and insert it here? It's a wonderful addition. And some of the other things they have up there as well. I want to just kind of quickly go through some of the other things in the book that I to call your attention to them or the paper. We dealt with the economics of recycling, its influence, and we realized that there are some problems with that. But I think one of the main points we want to raise is that as soon as you reduce this or any other issue to economics, you've lost. I can't quote the person, but it was in the Holden paper that we got at home, that the quote said something to the effect that until slavery in the last century became more than an economic issue, nothing was done. I mean, that's sort of the final outcome. But when it became more than an economic issue, something was finally done. You know, and that's true with so many other social issues. And when you think about it, certainly economics are important, but it's a very, in one sense, very small part of our lives. We dare not reduce any of these issues to simply economic issues, or we're in deep trouble. We listed some educational opportunities in the paper, and we wanted to lay this out on a congregational level, some things that you can do within your congregation. There are some suggestions here. Establishing a committee and so forth, dealing with sermons, litanies. We went through sort of a monthly thing about what your congregation can do, so that we tried to be, you know, as practical as possible in helping the congregation begin. You know, and certainly these are suggestions and need to be adapted to every congregation. Even in Wisconsin, most of our congregations are rural in our synod, but we have to do this somewhat differently in Madison than in a far rural community. But we went through all the months of the year making some suggestions as to what the congregation can do to begin developing this sort of a committee. We have a section on setting up a recycling program in your church, some ways of doing that, how to go about that, cooperation, what needs to be done, and so forth. I would add to this that if you can get your church council excited about this issue, you're really ahead of the game. I've been sort of beating this drum for quite a while in our church, and our church council has gotten very concerned about this. One of the goals for our church this next year, we go from June to June, is for our congregation to become a creation awareness center. We're going to be working that out in a council level. And 2 years ago, we rewrote our mission statement. We had read a little book, study book, written by Douglas Hall on stewardship, that he calls, I forget the name of the book, but it's been a while, but basically he says we need to redeem the idea of being stewards, that being stewards is to care for the whole creation. In the church, we've reduced that to fundraising. So we rewrote our whole mission statement that includes caring for all of creation. And we wrote it in more of an oriental sense, so that we work from caring for the creation to other peoples in the world, to those within our own country, those within our community, the families of our church and ourselves. So that we put that in what we felt was more of a biblical and proper perspective. There are things you can do, you know, within your congregation to sort of set this up, and we'll talk more thoroughly about those tomorrow. Hazardous waste in your home. We felt this was a very critical issue because there are just a lot of things within our home that we don't recognize as hazardous waste. And especially with small children around. So we have some practical issues here. Wow, is that the dinner bell? I've gone over it. And then we have some resources in the back that we hope might be helpful to you, some bibliography and so forth. So that basically is also walking through the paper with you. Again, this is something that if you'd like it, you're more than welcome to take with you. Well, we're finishing the time, and I guess we do have, how much time do we have?
1 minute.
1 minute. Mm-hmm. Any final comments that you'd like to make?
If there was somebody really creative, here's an idea to make $1 million and save the earth.
Oh.
And based upon a twofold need, the second need from coming from Southern California, we live on an irrigated desert, so we need all the water we can get. Some simple system whereby the water you use in the household could be regenerated. Run through some kind of a simple purifying system that coming out one end would be water, again, ready to drink and to use and what have you. Over here would be some tiny little atomized waste, what have you.
Yeah. Well, they have what they call a gray water system. Collects the water in the house that you can then use in gardening and things. You know, but not to...
It's only part of what I know.
Yeah. You're talking about drinking water.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, how much water do we throw down the sewer taking a shower? And
but
how much dirt in there?
Or you take a shower in water you could drink, and that's, I mean, we could take showers in water that is not clean enough to drink. We can flush toilets with water, with gray water. We can put gray water in the garden. There's a million ways we could use the amount of water that we actually drink is really not an awful lot.
No, you're overlooking what I'm suggesting, that if you could run all water through that and come out clean here and dust the ash over here, think of the money you could save on sewers, on piping additional water into the home and going up to your 15-story, you know, the size, the diameter of the tubing would be much, much smaller. Oh, think of the money that could be saved if there were.
But there's not really a need to do that with all the water.
Well,
because the bioorganisms would take care of some of it.
Facing a drought.
But why run it all out to the sea?
Why go through the expense of making it all perfect when we could use it in a dirty condition? I mean, the only water we really need to have that clean is the water that we drink or eat.
I'd like to butt in.
Butt in.
I don't want to end on a note of where we're still looking for a technological fix.
Yeah.
We this one channel down in Florida right before Earth Day was running these commercials that were saying, you know, well, the bad news is this, and they're giving out, you know, these figures about environmental degradation, and that the state of the world, 1990, states that if we do not turn around these certain things within 30 years, it's gone. We won't be able to reverse it. You know, the planet, we will not be able to sustain human life. The good news is we know what to do. The bad news is we have to want to change. Okay. And the good news for Christians is that we can be changed in the spirit of our mind by wanting to be part of God's creation and to love it and care for it. You know, we know what to do. What we have to do is first participate in caring for creation ourselves. And I find that there's a lot of joy in doing that, and that you can, that recharges you so you can go out and get other people involved in it. And it's almost like a pyramid thing. You know, if you get, you know, one more person to do it here, one more person there. So, and I just wanted to say, this is the only resource I know of like this.
Excellent. I really
appreciate it. So not only take it and share it with people in your congregation, and certainly do that and try to work it into an adult forum and try to do 4 Sundays on it or something like that. But call your synod office and find out who the individuals, whose responsibility would this fall into. Talk to that individual. See, you sent these to all the synods. See if that person, he or she, knows where it is. See if it's been filed away or thrown away or if they've got it, and you can adapt it to your area. Take out Wisconsin and write in Washington. And if states like Oregon and Washington have departments of environment, and you can find your own materials from them, you can get your own sites, recycling centers, and all that.
The instructions in the setting up recycling program in the church are not complete. They start off not too far down the road. The first how you begin should be to adapt it in your own home for a month or 2 or 3 or 4 and get used to it, and then begin to tell other people.
Well, some people have, though. One of the big deterrents, though, is the fact that American people are so busy, this takes concentration and devotion. Think of the time you've spent.